the profound and wondrous Dharma is rarely encountered even in 100 million jhanas. Having it to hear, accept, and maintain, may I taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Mary, I'll do a quick introduction. So, good morning. This is Stone Creek Zen Center's online reality. Thank you for joining this morning. This morning we have Mary Mosin giving the talk. Mary is a longtime friend of Jisho and of Stone Creek and of in that lineage, and then of Charlie and I. From our time at San Francisco Zen Center, we all live with Mary Mosin together. I was there, I think my first practice period, Mary was the Shuso at Tassajara. So we have lots of different connections. And Mary is a lawyer and also does Dharma training for people in law and is the founder of the Vallejo Zen Center. We call it the Vallejo Zen Center? Yes. And Mary, maybe you can say when you start talking how long that Zen Center has been in operation. Maybe over 10 years?
20.
20! Oh my gosh. Yeah. Time is warping. So thank you so much for being here, Mary, this morning, and welcome.
Thanks. I'm going to leave it with the tiles because I like to be able to see people's faces. I wish I had magic, and I wish I had, I don't know that I do. I started to say I wish I had more coherent thoughts, but I'm not so sure. Oh, you got, are you recording this, or would you please, or would you give me permission to? Oh, okay. And I, at any rate, I don't have very coherent thoughts. I have a lot. I have a lot of emotions. I wanted, just occurred to me as we were sitting that as I could feel the fear in my belly, that I thought I was scared a week ago. And now I'm much more scared. I'm scared because our karma, our collective karma, our karmic wound of racism and violence is manifesting. And it's been manifesting. Well, it's been manifesting since white people came here. But it's particularly been manifesting with the COVID-19 and the fact that people of color and poor people are paying for it with their lives much more than middle class and one percenters, white people. And that's been visible. And the lack of testing availability and so on has been visible. And the fact that poorer people, which includes a disproportionate number of people of color, are less able to distance themselves, are less able to stop working. If you order a lot now online to be delivered, what do the people look like that deliver things? So it was already showing. Was it Obama who said something about that the veil has been lifted? I think so. And it was Biden who referred to our deep wound. Native Americans paid the price, and slaves, African people, and African Americans down the generations paid the price. And now, with the killing of George Floyd, and I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, Breonna Taylor. And I'm not going to go down the list, but it's long. Sangha member sent a list, and I didn't count it, but it, you know, and it was only about recent killings of people of color by peace officers. In my mind's eye, I can see it. It looked like it had at least 30 names. And now there are demonstrations and riots. And as often happens, the businesses that get burned and trashed are often of local people, people of color even, because their businesses are accessible. And who are these people? I don't know. It's part of my fear. Who are the people that are trashing things? It's not clear to me. They come out in Oakland, I know that. And I don't know how to even analyze it. So they look like a lot of white, super radical people. But I don't know who they are. And they're not all white. And I'm scared. And I imagine you're scared too. I said yesterday here lecturing, I said, if you're not scared, you're not paying attention. And I wish I had magic, and I don't. Maybe I do. It's called Zazen. Have you read the wonderful book by Ruth Ozeki called A Tale for the Time Being? The grandmother taught her daughter there, her granddaughter, she taught her a superpower. The grandmother was a Buddhist nun, I guess, and a priest, whatever. And she taught her granddaughter a superpower, which was Zazen. So we have this. We're sitting in the middle of this wound of racism and violence that is our heritage, all of us, black, white, recent, family here since the Mayflower, whatever. You know, I don't believe in karma as a sort of a tit for tat thing. You know, I got cancer because I murdered somebody in my past life. I don't think it's so simple. However, I do think my experience is that I am the recipient of innumerable causes and conditions, tangled, twisted, beyond my knowing. What I do know is I'm the recipient. I am moment after moment presented with events, let's say, causes and conditions, experiences. So how do I practice with it? How do I deal with it? And we have a karmic condition, I guess. I'm not going to try to figure out anyway. We're the recipients of karmic causes and conditions, innumerable actions and choices, a lot of violence. You know, Black people have been rebelling against slavery since it started. And you don't learn much about it in school, but they were happening all the time. And you can read, if you read Jill Lepore's book, These Truths, she writes about it a lot. And I was happy to read it. That they didn't accept it passively. And yes, I know it was violent. And slavery was violent. But we now, this second, are the we're both the result of all that, and we are the recipients of it. So we have racism, we have COVID-19, and we have a government that doesn't seem to care much about people of color or poor people. And in fact, exacerbates divisions and racism and violence. So any one of those is frightening enough. That it's quite a combination. And for me, it always comes back to, how do I practice with this? How do I practice with it? What's the point? What's the point? Why do we just say, go sit zazen? What the hell does zazen have to do with it? Everything, of course. I think we have to start right here, which means sit down, get quiet, and pay attention. And pay attention and pay attention and notice. Notice as I talk to you, I have a lump in my throat. I have a lot of tension right here in my chest, and I have fear in my belly, and I can feel it. And I can breathe into it. And I can allow it to arise, abide, and pass away in my body without needing to tell a lot of stories about it. And that's my superpower. That's the fruit of practice. So let's just take a moment to check in with your body, check in with your belly and your breath. And your jaw, wherever you carry tension. Check in and just give it some breath. Breathe into it. Nope, do not, if you can avoid it, do not talk to yourself about it. Just experience it. years ago when my parents were dying within a few months of each other, and I was working with a lot of fear of death. My teacher, Sojin Mel Weitzman Roshi, told me, I told him about my fear, and he said, breathe into it. And my face must have changed because I misunderstood him just as he saw that I did. And he said, I don't think he quite slapped the mat in the Doksan room, but it was close enough. He basically said, I'm not telling you to repress it. And I went back and I did it. And I breathed into my belly, into that fear, and things changed. So we sit down and we pay attention. We get quiet. And from there, we respond. From there, we respond. Because as I imagine you, I'm sure you know, if you respond out of the fear, if you respond out of the anger, well, actually, you're probably reacting rather than responding. And you get hurt and other people get hurt. So you are not only protecting yourself, you're protecting others when you first sit down and get quiet and pay attention. And from there, according to your karmic conditions, the formations of your life, you respond. And that is up to you. That's your freedom, is how you respond. Do you read more books? Do you join the, I'm not sure what it's called now, it's the Dharma Racism book group. Do you go to a demonstration? You can write your representatives, but we are in California pretty much represented by people with whom we would agree, I think. I do. I am, at any rate. Do you educate yourself more? Do you resolve to be an ally? Asian people are being targeted now too. How we respond is up to us. I think that we have to start though. I believe we have to start by acknowledging the wounds. I would call it genocide of Native Americans, knowingly killing off the buffalo. Sometimes unknowingly infecting them, herding them onto, through trails of tears onto reservations and so on. I think we have to acknowledge it. It is It's our homework. I often talk about homework, that you have homework to do. If you have some personal kind of wound that's keeps recurring, that you need to turn towards it and allow it to arise, abide, and guess what? It passes away. If you will allow it to come up, then it can go. It may come back, but your relationship with it will change. And our relationship with this wound of racism and violence can only change if we start by acknowledging that it exists. And I think that is our practice. Dogen and Genjo Koan said, Koan says, you know, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. But the first is to study the self. And many years ago now, I talked to Shohaku Okamura about it. And I asked him if he thought that Dogen was referring not only to noticing that you don't have one, or realizing that there's just self-selfing with a capital S, but did he also mean study the nitty-gritty of yourself? And Shohaku Okamura Roshi said, yes, of course, absolutely. I'm sure that he meant that too. That's one of the many reasons I like him. So we need to study the self. And know how each of us, I need to know how I manifest these wounds. I have to know my racism. I have to know my biases. And Zazen gives me the courage and the faith to sit still and acknowledge these things and look at them. I'm not so much talking about thinking about them, but noticing if I am walking down the street and a black man comes in the opposite direction, coming towards me, noticing that I get a little bit tight. Noticing my body, noticing where my breath is. And giving it some breath and letting it go and saying hi. And guess what? They say hi back. This is my practice now. It doesn't mean that I act foolishly. I wear a mask when I go out. I take the COVID-19 seriously. I mean, I'm old and I have COPD, so I have to. But I like to think I would anyway. And I certainly take my racism, and it's shorthand, I'll say my sexism. You know, the better term is my internalized oppression. But my sexism, I take it seriously. And I vow to include it. It's, in a sense, it's my wound to heal. And when I can't, I'm not going to wait until I am perfectly healed and not racist at all and not sexist and so on. I'm not going to wait for that. But I am, and in order to take actions and educate myself and so on. But I want to continue to do my homework, and I want to always include it. So I'm not so much caught by surprise, if that makes sense. So that's what magic I have. That's what magic I have. Sit down. Sit down and let it in, let it go, and then see what happens. So, are there questions or comments? So, how does this work? Do people just put their hands in gusho, or do you call on them, or do I call on them, or what?
People will just unmute themselves if they have a question.
Okay.
And then just to remind people to remute yourself, just so there's not background noise.
Okay. So if I put it on speaker view, they'll show up.
Then you can see who's talking. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Please don't be afraid. There aren't any dumb questions.
Mary?
Yeah?
Thank you for your talk very much. I have a question specifically for this format and this time we're in. I know I really rely on Sangha for helping me with my blind spots. And it's all well and good to sit down and do Zazen, which I try to do. Well, I do every day, but I guess I'm of the nature to be generous about my own blind spots, that I'm blind to myself.
Uh-huh.
Often even in my Zazen, blind to myself, things don't arise. That maybe, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I rely on my Sangha. I rely on other people, their responses, their actions, their body language. How best to cope with that now?
Like that. Take a breath. I share that, and I, you know, some of that's available from Zoom. Vallejo Sangha and a lawyer Sangha I work with both were surprised at the intimacy of Zoom. You know, it's not the same as being together, but there is some intimacy, and it's, I was surprised. So that's one way. And maybe you know, you should work with your teacher about this, I guess, or a spiritual friend kind of person. But years ago, my first practice leader, a woman named Maile Scott, early on when I was practicing at the Berkeley Zen Center, I'd probably been practicing for maybe 6 months or something, and we used to go out to breakfast together. And we were walking back towards the Zendo, and she said to me, you know, you might invite your demons up. Oh, my God! And so I did. And at first I said to myself, as I sat, I said at the beginning of a period of Zazen, I would say, to the extent I can stand it, please come up. Because it was too scary. You know, and I figured, okay, I'll just make a little bit of a container or something. And eventually I figured my psyche would not allow up more than I could stand. And so I just said, and plus I knew I was talking to myself, right? I knew what I meant. So I just said, please come up. But that is one way, that sense of not sitting there thinking about it, but that sense of sitting with a feeling of inquiry. And what is this? What is this? And if there's some particular thing, putting your intention on paying attention to something or another. And then when you go to sleep at night, ask yourself, what is this? And maybe right now that might not be a good idea because you might not be able to sleep. But I don't know, but I mean, I am really frightened. It has the feeling in my belly now is less, but it's not gone. Anyway, to really intentionally work on something. And as you do that, you'll get, as I mentioned, from practice, you notice more in your daily life. And you can use your breath, notice your breath, notice where your breath is in your body. Another thing Sojourn said years ago was, a good Zen student always knows where her breath is. Well, I don't always, but I know it a lot more than I used to, and it is my intention to know that your breath can tell you a lot. You know, if it's up here in your chest, that tells you something. So I think it's an intentionality, and to remember that we will get through this. We will be together again. It may be not quite the same as it was. I don't know. I don't know what the vaccine will be like, assuming there'll be one within the next year. We'll see. But we will be together again, maybe spaced with masks or something, but we will be together again.
Mary? I mean, this is a really serious subject. It's, a vital subject. And how do we deal with it meaningfully? And one way, I wanted to show you something. Can you see what that is?
No, I'm sorry. It's just sort of black and white.
It's a picture of the Earth.
Oh,
so we have been, I hate to say it, but while we were listening to your talk and beforehand, we were watching the space people dock into the space station and climb in. And it was such a moment of triumph. And I think that although we could be consumed by what's going on with our with racism, we also have to look to the good things to balance our lives and, like I said, not be consumed by what's going on around us.
I absolutely agree with you. I think we have to take care of ourselves, because again, if we're not, then again we're in that position of being reactive rather than responsive. And that's all I have a lecture. years ago, I noticed that both Robert Aiken and Thich Nhat Hanh said that you need recreation. And I think Aiken pointed out that it's recreation. We need downtime. We need time of pleasure. And I think that for me anyway, unless I deal with, acknowledge and allow the bodily sensations to arise, the anger and the fear and the anxiety, unless I allow that to arise, I don't notice the flowers. I can't see the cedar waxwing come to my toyon bush and so on. So they're intimately connected, I think. And thank you for reminding us, because yes, it's absolutely necessary.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. Need to unmute.
I think I'm muted. No, mute.
There you go. You just...
Mary?
Yeah, but there was somebody before you that wait a second. She's...
Okay.
Wait. So we can just check. Both Cindy and Annette have been unmuted. If you're, I don't know if it's like.
Yeah, the thing is that I think Annette remuted her. So you both hit it at the same time. So now she's unmuted.
There, I'm unmuted. Thank you. There's a few mute buttons. Thank you for, well, how do you say, taking this on, but speaking so simply and directly in such a difficult time and difficult topics. When you speak of, you said there were like three things: sit down, do something, and let go. That letting go is, I'm curious what that means for you. Because it's just something that I find difficult in the midst of the discomfort, and you articulate the physical discomfort so specifically, it has me feeling it. So I will be quiet, and I want to know what you mean and what is the act of letting go.
Well, it's interesting because I did use the phrase letting go, but my thing was sit down, get quiet, pay attention. And then I would say allow it to whatever is there. And I am very much a body practice person. I'm not so interested in my story about the fear in my belly. I'm interested in the physical sensation. And I learned a lot about that from Joko Beck. At any rate, so I think letting go is a matter of allowing myself to experience whatever it may be, of turning towards whatever it may be, you know, and also not beating myself up, because sometimes I cannot turn towards it, or I do, and then I start thinking and I, whatever, and then gently coming back. I have just recently relocated this sign.
Yes, take a kindly, friendly interest.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, that's part of that inquiry also.
Yes, but a kindly, friendly one.
Yeah.
And the letting go, I think happens, my experience is that it happens organically out of my willingness to be with the difficulty, my willingness to kind of do my homework, to invite my demons up and be present and physically experience what it is. And I loosen my grip on my ideas and my opinions and my wounds, I guess, too, you know. So that's what I mean by letting go. It's like allow that process to happen. And, you know, you have personal wounds. We all have personal wounds, primal wounds from our childhood and whatever. And that never goes away entirely, but your relationship with it changes. And it doesn't have the power over you that it used to. And you don't get pulled around by your emotions and your thoughts and so on quite the way you used to. But it's not something you can legislate. You know, one of my many mottos is trying does not work. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only... I think put your attention, intention on paying attention, and see what happens. So now the other person. Was that Robin?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. And I wonder if you can say anything about, as a privileged white person, how to get away from feeling so guilty. from.
Yeah. Cut it out. It's not. I mean, really, I that's sort of a glib answer, but it's totally not useful to come from a place of guilt. It's only toxic to it is toxic to everybody. I mean, at Berkeley High a long time ago, I guess it was the late 60s, early 70s, there was a huge amount of kind of racial tension on the Berkeley High campus. And the Black kids were guilt-tripping the white liberal kids, of which, of course, at Berkeley High, there were many. And some of the white kids really took it on, and one of them killed herself. Now, who knows why she killed herself? You know, I'm sure there were lots of reasons. It had nothing to do with that. But that just not useful. Coming from a place of guilt is not useful. And that is one of our many wounds, one of our common wounds, and a common reaction to being feeling guilty is to hate the person that made you feel guilty, which only compounds it. And I know you look at it, you feel it when it comes up, what does it feel like in your body? And it feels yucky. And as you pay attention, you notice that impulse to blame the other. It's not, you know, and then you if you're practicing, you notice it and you remind yourself, oh, I'm the one making me feel guilty. And it's not useful. It's just not useful. And the only way is to keep looking at it in your own body and noticing. And I think those things, my experience is that those kinds of unwholesome responses lighten up, lessen their grip when I'm aware of them. And I can figuratively step back and take another look. And that's, you know, the appropriate question, I think, is how can I be useful? What's a bodhisattva to do? And then you just do. You know the story of Avalokiteshvara with the 11 heads. You've seen those statues, maybe? Mm-hmm. And what she did was she went down to hell and she saved all the beings in hell. And she's helping the last one out, and she turns to wave goodbye to that person, and then she turns back to enjoy the view of empty hell, and it's full again, and her head explodes. So she grows another head, and then she empties hell out again, and she does it again, and she looks back, and it's full, and her head explodes, and she keeps doing that until finally she gets that's just her job, just help. Get people, be useful to the people in the hell room. And that's our job. And we don't know what use it is. We're just be useful as you can, and as kind as you can. Come back to this. Make a sign, put it on your altar. This I learned, this is from take a kindly, friendly interest. That was teaching of Yvonne Rand a long time ago. And I put it on my altar and it was off. And now in our class here in Vallejo, we've been using When Things Fall Apart, and that came up. And so I thought it was a good time to get it out again. So be kind to yourself. Don't forget to include yourself in your well-wishing. No. May we be safe, happy, at ease. Not they, we. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Mary, can I offer one more?
Sure.
Okay, last one. I'm curious about the fear you're talking about, and I'm wary of the fear. as a white person among white people, because I think, there's just the genuineness, the authentic, genuine experience you're having with what's happening in your belly. But I think we do have to not have stories about it, but to investigate, because I think there are stories about our imminent peril. And I think what I just find myself interested in predominant white spaces, like our sangha is not exclusively white, but it is predominantly white, of as white people talking to each other and acknowledging the relative protections we have, mm-hmm. you know, and the lack of peril actually. And just as you were saying to Robin, and so how do we use those? How do we make use of that? So the circumstances that we didn't get asked to be born into them, but we got these privileges. We have to first own them, and then we have to own them so thoroughly that we can, make them power. The fear can be so disempowering, but I think the truth is we are incredibly powerful. And not just as white people, each human being is incredibly powerful. And I think in the collective kind of dominant white culture, we have stories of our disempowerment. You know, this is too big, and this is not my fault, and this is the government, or it's the corporations, or whatever. The systems of oppression. I can't even touch them. But it's no, actually, we have a tremendous amount of agency. And as white people, we have a lot of power.
I say yes, and. Yes, and I'm hesitant, especially because I'm a visitor, to sort of tell people what to do. And I think we have to know, we do have to, or at least it's useful to know our fear, and breathe, give it breath. And mine, if I do, I didn't. It turns out that Sojin was right. He was not telling me to repress it. But with breathing into it, it changed. I guess when I came to terms with it, I wasn't so afraid of being afraid, maybe is a way to say it. Anyway, it changed. And we are powerful. And we do absolutely need to own our white privilege. I mean, that's how I think of when I say something about educating yourself. That's what I mean, or, to understand how systemic it is. How the GI Bill kind of didn't apply to Black people. And the redlining segregated them into ghettos. And the way, was it Robert Moses designed the access to Golden Gate, to Central Park, made it hard for people to get there on public transportation. And on and on and on. There's a wonderful picture of Robert Aiken holding a sign, like a picket sign that says the system sucks. So I think we have to also understand the systemic nature of this and the systemic ramifications of it. And I am a very political person. I am a left-wing political person and have been for a long time. And you don't have to share my politics to share my concerns but you have to do it in your way. So yes, Sarah, but it's yes and. Does that make sense? Or do you want to say anything more?
No, thank you. So we'll chant, and then we have time for announcements after that. Thank you.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Four great bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless. I am. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are infinite. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is boundless. I vow to realize it.
Thank you again, Mary.
Thank you, Mary.
So nice to, so good to have you here with our Sangha and responding, especially this week.